We have a special guest presenter for the first bit of this. It took a little bit of prodding on my part to get her to agree to say something, but Sister Rachel decided this week that she was going to do a fast. And so she was going to share with us graciously, because she didn't want to, a little bit of her experience. And so...
I feel really odd telling you about this because my aunt, it's kind of a private thing, but here I am. So I was sitting in class on Tuesday, and I'm one of those people where, I'm sorry, I ran from my trailer. If something makes sense, then I just go do it. So I had, you know, I'm listening to everybody's questions about all the medical side effects of fasting. I'm sitting there going, just do it. So I decided on Tuesday to fast, and I was going to fast until tonight. And I started Tuesday night at, I think I had a plum, so I'm going to start at 11 o'clock at night on Tuesday. And all I did from Tuesday until yesterday lunchtime was drink herbal tea and water. And I felt great. Except the hardest time was on Wednesday between 4:30 and 5:30 in the AGM meeting and the committee meeting. I was really, really lightheaded, really, really dizzy, and I wanted to lie down, which was not an option. And then I was in choir, and then Peter says, okay, let's all stand and sing this incredibly rousing song, and I'm like, no. So I didn't stand for that. So that was really the hardest time, was between 4:30 and... So that was about... 18 hours into my fast, I began to feel lightheaded and dizzy, and it really lasted for an hour. At no point did I feel hungry, and it was actually easy to do it at Manuka, although somebody asked me, why are you doing it at Manuka when there's fantastic food there? Well, I'm not cooking. The last time I fasted, I had children at home, and I had to still cook for them and cook for John and fast, and that was really, really hard. So it was easy for me to be here and not eat. The downside to that was that I missed the fellowship, because that's what I love. I love Manuka, and the highlight of Manuka for me is not really the food, but just sitting and talking to people. And I missed that because I would sit on the bench outside and pray. And that was amazing for me. My prayer life has really gone up a notch in the last couple of years, and my prayers were already answered from just sitting on the bench, and that's really special to me, and I don't want to talk about that. Let's see. I walked to Crown Point one morning, which is a 4-mile walk. I managed to do that. The only reason I stopped my fast was because I really wanted to do the dancing last night, and John was worried that I would get dizzy and fall over. So I ate a piece of pizza and some fruit for lunch on Thursday, and I really was not hungry. I had to make myself do it. And then I had dinner on Thursday night, and about an hour later, I was outside talking to somebody, and I felt terrible having eaten. Like an hour after I ate, I felt fuzzy-headed, and I wished I hadn't eaten. I don't know if anybody wants any questions. That's really all I had to say. Oh, the hardest thing was I ran an errand Thursday morning because I wanted to get cameras for the rafters. And there was Starbucks. That was really, really hard not to go get a latte. And I had to drive past and not do it. So I was proud of myself. That was harder than smelling the food here. Yeah. How was it at night? Could you sleep? Oh, I felt great. Except that 1 hour when I was dizzy, 18 hours into it. But the best part for me was to sit out there by myself and look at the view and just pray and feel the warm sun on my back, and that was really what made it for me. I would imagine that would be a sugar low if you're dizzy, isn't it? I don't know. I'm like him. I don't know anything about it, but I do it. That's how I live. Okay.
Did your mind brighten up? Can you tell us about that?
I was going to make a joke about that because, well, I mean, I could joke about it because I'm teaching at VIBC in a couple weeks, and I decided I'm going to teach Revelation. So I wish I could tell you that I sat out there and I read Revelation. I understand it clearly now. But I did. I don't think I was in it long enough to have my mind suddenly become brighter. I mean, I really wished I hadn't eaten yesterday. I regret eating yesterday because I don't think I would have been dizzy dancing. Fine. But I would do it. Don't worry about. I mean, God would not put something out there for us to do that harms us. So, I don't know. Just do it. That's all I have to say.
She didn't want to do that, so I really appreciate her doing that. Okay, we finished yesterday, we were going to talk about Habakkuk, or however you want to say that. So I'm going to give you a 5-minute Habakkuk overview, just so you can get the gist of what I think is the important point. So if we start off, the first 4 verses of Habakkuk is Habakkuk questioning God. This I think is a really, really cool book. Not that they're all not, but because this is Habakkuk directly questioning God. You know, this is a dialogue with God. And so Habakkuk wants to know how long the righteous are going to be able or just suffer in Judah. And this is a question that we all have. How long? You know, is this things, I can tell you this, and I tell you this, I'm absolutely wrong, but I would not run the world the way God runs it. Good things would happen to good people, and bad things would happen to bad people. That's the way I do it. And that would be absolutely wrong, obviously, but that's the way I do it. And Habakkuk obviously sympathizes with that perspective because he's wondering the same thing. You know, how come good people, you know, bad things happen to good people and good things happen to bad people? God, you know, what are you doing? So that's the first 4 verses. And then God gives an interesting answer. He says, well, I'm going to take care of that. I'm going to send the Chaldeans down and they're going to slaughter you guys. Now, that's sort of like, you know, complaining to the teacher at recess that the bullies are picking on people in the playground and the teacher's saying, well, we'll just kill everybody. But that's God's response. Now, naturally, when Habakkuk gets that response, he's going, whoa, wait a minute. But we're more holy than the Chaldeans. Well, wait a minute, Habakkuk, you were just arguing how wicked everybody was, and now you're arguing, we're righteous. We're more righteous than the Babylonians anyway. So, then we get into chapter 2, and God says, in the long run, everything's going to work out. I'm in control, Habakkuk. And then he has a famous verse, one of the more poignant verses, I think, in Scripture, the last verse in Habakkuk chapter 2. But the Lord is in His holy temple. Let all the earth be silent before Him. You know, like Habakkuk, shh. You know, there's 2 jobs in the world. There's jobs of human beings and there's God's job. Which one do you think is going to be messed up, Habakkuk? I got my job, okay? Just chill out, as they say. And then in Habakkuk 3, Habakkuk understands. It clicks in for him and he gets it. God is in control. God is working for good. Let God do His job and we focus on ours. Okay, so that's my understanding in a nutshell of the prophecy of Habakkuk. But what is interesting in here, it says the word famine means literally to put your hand over your mouth. And of course, God tells Habakkuk, but the Lord is in His holy temple. Let all the earth keep silent before Him. You know, shh, you know. Isn't it funny, just another side observation, that Christadelphians tend to argue about the things that are God's job? You know, he's going to do everything just fine. Maybe we should focus a little bit more on our job and less on his. So, but here's where, why I'm even talking about this in a fasting class. Because, and we've been talking, remember yesterday, about fasting and famine. But he says here in the last part of chapter 3, and again, these probably are some of my favorite words in the Bible. Although the fig tree shall not blossom, neither shall fruit be in the vines, the labor of the olive shall fail, and the field shall not yield no meat, the flock shall be cut off from the fold, and there shall be no herd in the stalls, yet I will rejoice in the Lord. I will joy in the God of my salvation. What Habakkuk is describing is famine. He's describing a famine situation. Now, again, I'm not sure we can relate to what famine is. Because, you know, when we want food, we run down to the Quickie Mart or to, you know, the Starbucks, or we run down to McDonald's or something, and we can fill our bellies. This was an agrarian culture. If you lost your crop for the year, if there was some disease that went through your cattle, you didn't, you know, call the 18-wheelers from Persia and send them over. They didn't have that mode. You see this over and over again in the Bible with, you know, like Abraham, you go to where the food is because that's the answer, because the food's not coming to you. So, but what he says here and what he recognizes is that even in these famine conditions, yet I will rejoice in the Lord. I will joy in the God of my salvation. God is sufficient for us. And he's not going to test us beyond what we're able to bear. And that's a promise that we have. And so, you know, we find that our attitude, our joy in the Lord, should not be dictated by our outward circumstances. Mentally, spiritually, we should be, our cup runneth over all the time. That's where God wants us to be. And this is what Habakkuk had to learn. Now another lesson, another Bible parable that talks about famine and this the relationship between famine and fasting and what we're supposed to learn is the parable of the prodigal son. Of course, we know the story. The son went off for riotous living, and when he had spent it all, there arose a mighty famine in the land, and he began to be in want, and he went and joined himself to a citizen of that country. And he sent him into his fields to feed swine. And that would be pretty hard for a good Jewish boy to do. And he would fain have filled his belly with the husk from that the swine did eat. No man gave unto him. And when he came to himself, now you gotta, I think this begs the question, and again, this is just a parable, this didn't really happen, but it begs the question, would the prodigal son have come to his senses without the famine? Probably not. So if this was a real thing, which it wasn't, you know, would it have been worth it for a area or region to go through famine for one person to be saved eternally? And he said, how many of my hired servants of my father's have bread enough to spare, and I perish with hunger? I will arise and go unto my father and will say unto him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and before thee, and am no more worthy to be called thy son. Make me as one of thy hired servants. And he arose and came to his father. And that's what God wants, is he wants us to come to him. And again, why we're talking about this is self-discipline versus God's discipline. Do we want God to have to discipline us, or do we want to discipline ourselves? I think we would all prefer to discipline ourselves. I think God would prefer for us to discipline ourselves. So let's talk about the nature of trials. Here is a story from John 9, 1 to 3. And he went along and he saw a man who had been blind from birth. And his disciples asked him, "Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he should have been born blind?" "Neither he nor his parents sinned," Jesus answered. "He was born blind so that the works of God might be revealed in him." Well, what does it mean for the works of God to be revealed in him? You know, I used to think that what this thing was saying was that this guy was born blind for the specific purpose that Jesus could come along and heal him X number of years later. And I do not believe that to be the case anymore. I believe this is a general principle that all of these things happen so that the works of God might be revealed in us. All of these things that happen, all of these trials that come upon us, the works of God need to be revealed to us and in us. How many times have you been exhorted more than anything you'll hear from this side of the podium by the way that someone has persevered under trial and just been mesmerized and thrilled at someone's faith in trial? A far greater exhortation than you're ever going to hear from this side of the podium. And so, again, I think this is a general principle for all trials, that fill in the blank of the trial was so that the works of God might be revealed in him, her, us. So, let's look at some test cases. So the works of God might be revealed in him appropriate. Was that appropriate for Joseph being thrown into prison? Were the works of God revealed in him? Is that appropriate for that circumstance? How about Jesus driven into the wilderness so that the works of God might be revealed in him? How about the apostles and their suffering in the first century? Was it so that the works of God might be revealed in them? How about Jeremiah thrown into the pit and all that he suffered so that the works of God might be revealed in him? Well, what about all of us? What about all our little trials and tribulations that we go through? Again, now, here's another thing about trials and something I had to get my mind around. True or false, does God test us to see how we will respond? False. Why is that false? Because he knows how we'll respond. Who doesn't know how we're going to respond? Us. That took me some time to recognize, you know, that God was doing these things to see how we will respond. But that's not it. That's not the omnipotent God that we worship, that sort of playing experiments with us to see how things are going to come out. It doesn't work that way. Again, God is all-knowing, so he doesn't need to know how we will respond. If it did, wouldn't that somehow pit God against us? Could we feel the comfort of God in a trial, knowing that he was just kind of seeing if we could pass it or not? And what promise would that be? He would not give us any trial beyond what we're able to bear if he doesn't really even know how we're going to stand up in this trial. So, again, you know, if you just sort of dig into that idea, you know, God is testing us to see how we respond, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense. God gets us through our trials. And if we turn to him and respond to him and rely on him, that's the way we get through the trials. But if we look at him as somehow pitted against us, as somehow an enemy in this thing, then that's probably going to be the last place we're going to want to turn. So here's I asked some brethren why they thought God tests us, and just share with you some of their responses. Because he loves us and is in the process of molding us to be like his son. Since we've talked with God, God brings us to learn whether we'll walk the walk. So, oh, I'm sorry, since we've talked the talk, God brings us trials for us to learn whether we'll walk the walk. As a loving Father, God disciplines us for our good. He tests us to develop our character, strengthen our love, and trust in Him. I believe that it is largely to shape us for His purpose, as several biblical examples show. Job, David, Paul, Peter, men's character and disposition are shaped by their experiences, often for God's specific purpose, so that we realize that our only strength comes through Him and because of Him. And I thought all of those were excellent answers, but again, not a one of them said to see how we respond. So why does God test us? Because He loves us, because for us to learn, because we need the discipline to develop our characters, to shape us for His purpose, and so that we realize that only our strength comes through Him. And there's probably many more that we could throw up there. So again, this is in the context of self-discipline versus God's discipline. And I would tell you this as a general principle too. It seems to me that getting those last little bits of, not that I'm to this point in my life, but getting these last little bits of refining out takes more. That makes sense, what I'm trying to say. To refine our characters, that those last little bits, like Job. Look at what happened to Job, and he was a righteous man. Now, again, I don't personally believe that the trials that came upon Job were primarily for his benefit, although he did benefit a little bit. But I think that his three friends were, in fact, saved through this process. We benefit tremendously from it. So here's Romans 8:31-37. After saying this, what can we add? If God is for us, who can be against us? Since He did not spare His own Son, but gave Him up for the sake of us all, then can we not expect that with Him He will freely give us all gifts, all His gifts? Who can bring any accusation against those that God has chosen? When God grants saving justice, who can condemn? Are we not sure that it is Christ Jesus who died, yes, and more, was raised from the dead, and is at God's right hand, and who is adding His plea for us? Now, you can scratch that from my perspective, but that's a bad translation. Anyway, can anything cut us off from the love of Christ? Can hardships or distress or persecution or lack of food or clothing, or threats of violence, as Scripture says, for your sake we are being massacred all day long, treated as sheep being slaughtered? No, we come through all these things triumphantly victorious by the power of Him who loved us. And so none of these things, brothers and sisters, can hurt us. They're only for our good. They're all working for our good because God is working for our good and Christ is working for our good. And if we glean from these things what we need to better develop our character, or to shine our light before men by the way that we handle these trials, you know, it's all good. And we've got an amazing promise that's very unique, that all these things are working for our good. That, to me, is as important as the promises made to Abraham. It really helps me get through life. That these promises that God is for us, He's not somehow pitted against us. And of course, we're all familiar with this passage. It says, "Have you forgotten that encouraging text in which you are addressed as sons? My son, do not scorn correction from the Lord. Do not resent His training, for the Lord trains those He loves. He chastises every son He accepts. Perseverance is part of your training. God is treating you as His sons. Has there ever been any son whose father does not train him? If you were not getting this training, as all of you are, then you would not be sons, but bastards. Besides, We have all had our human fathers who punished us, and we respected them for it. All the more readily we ought to submit to the Father of spirits and so earn life. Our human fathers were training us for short life according to their own lights. But He does it for our own good so that we might share in His holiness. So there's three elements here. We've got correction, love, and benefit. We need some tweaking. We need some correction. We benefit from God's love, and it really is a benefit to us. And we don't think of it that way often, but that's the way it really is. Okay, so let's go to a bad Kyle analogy. I like to think of our lust as a fingerprint. It's unique to each individual. What desires I have, that's all word lust to me. Lust can be good, by the way. It's not always a bad word in the Bible. And lust is, having these lusts in us is a not necessarily a bad thing. We have a desire to eat. That's not necessarily a bad thing. We have a desire to procreate. That's not necessarily a bad thing. It's only when these things are taken outside of a godly context that they become a bad thing. And that's where self-discipline comes in. And each one of us is absolutely unique. We've each got our own set of desires, which is unique to us. You know, they tend to run in general patterns amongst us, right? But they're all unique. So one of the problems we have in the Bible is the Greek word for temptation and trial is the same Greek word. It's sort of like evil in the Old Testament. In the evil in the Old Testament, you've got moral evil, which is sin, and you've got natural evil, which is like disasters. And God has nothing to do with the one and everything to do with the other. So you have to judge from the context what the Hebrew word evil means in the Old Testament. And you have to judge from the context what the Greek word for temptation trial is in the New Testament. So one of these things that comes into play, let's read James 1, 12 to 15, because this explains the process that we go through. Blessed is the man that endureth temptation, for when he is tried, he shall receive the crown of life, which the Lord hath promised to them that love Him. Let no man say when he is tempted, I am tempted of God. For God cannot be tempted with evil, neither tempteth He any man. But every man is tempted when he is drawn away of his own lust and enticed. Then when lust hath conceived, it bringeth forth sin, and sin, when it is finished, bringeth forth death. Okay, so this is the process of sin, and it's important that we understand this. And it's understanding why self-discipline is so important. Okay. So, blessed is the man that endureth temptation. Now, is that temptation or trial? Well, we don't know yet. We'll just keep on. Let no man say when he is tempted, I am tempted of God. Now, does God try us? Absolutely, God tries us. So that word there, we know by the context, is not saying that God, let no man say when he is tried, I am tried by God. Because we know that He does try us. So that word there is correctly translated. We know it's temptation. And what's the difference between temptation and trial? That's very murky for some people. I'm explaining with a bad analogy here in a minute. All right, God cannot be tempted with evil. We know that. Neither tempteth He any man. All right, but He does try us. So He doesn't tempt us, but He does try us. What's the difference? Okay, well, let's start with the beginning. But every man is tempted when he is drawn away of his own lust. Okay, so we've got these desires sitting in us. And so I'll use me as an example. You know, I'm just going along on my merry way, you know, and thinking good thoughts and stuff. And all of a sudden, something pops out in front of me that excites my lust. You know, maybe it's a woman in a bikini or something like that. Wasn't thinking about that, but there it is. Okay? And, you know, the heart gets pumping and you start thinking. And those lusts are there. And they're, again, there's no sin involved in this. It's just, this is what happens. But then we come to a crossroads where we have to make a decision between right and wrong, between following our way and our will versus God's way and His will. That's a temptation. That's that moral fork in the road. That's what a temptation is. When your lusts are excited and you come to that fork in the road and you've got to choose one way or the other, that's a temptation. That's why Jesus was tried like us, and whenever he got to that fork in the road, he was tempted like us, and his lust got excited because Jesus had lust like us, but he always took the right fork in the road. He never went the wrong way. So let me use my quick 7-Eleven story, and this is my bad analogy. Got two brothers that go into 7-Eleven in the middle of the night to get a cup of coffee. And one of them walks in and is buying the coffee. And let's say, for the sake of argument, that God makes the phone ring in the back. Okay? And the guy leaves the front of the counter and he heads to the back and he leaves the cash drawer open. Okay? And so he's in the back and you're standing there with your cup of coffee. And the first brother looks down there and sees that cash drawer open, looks around. Guy's in the back. He's thinking, man, I got bills. I could sure use that money. I really want that money. And his heart gets going, and he comes to that crossroads. Do I take the money or not? You know? And so he's got a temptation. Okay? Second scenario. Second brother walks into the 7-Eleven. Sake of argument, God makes the phone ring in the back. Exactly the same. Guy walks in the back, and the cash drawer is left open. Never enters his mind to take that money. Never enters his mind to take that money. Sees it. Boy, that guy shouldn't have left that cash drawer open. Who knows who's going to come in here, you know, that sort of thing. Never is tempted. Doesn't enter his mind to take the money. And you know people like that. Same trial, one was tempted, one was not. Why? Because of their lust fingerprint. One had a lust for money, one didn't. The second brother wasn't tempted by that money, would be tempted by something else. And that's the way it works. That's the difference between a temptation and a trial. So God could have given both of those brothers the same trial and only one of them reacted because of his lust. And I believe that God keeps working those lusts to teach us. And if we've got a problem in an area, he's going to keep giving us problems in that area until we fix it. And he's not doing it to trip us up, and he's not doing it to see if we're going to pass it or not. He's trying to get us to finally learn the lesson. Turn away, Kyle, your eyes from that woman in the bikini. Don't go back for the third, fourth, fifth look. So this is how trials, and you know, we were talking about fasting and famine and all this. You know, this is a bigger general picture. This is about what this is all about. It's about self-discipline. It's about benefiting from the trials. It's about accepting God's help. You know, when he gives us these opportunities to fix these things in our lives, whatever that is, whether it's a lust for food, or whether it's a lust for money, or whether it's a lust for fame and fortune, or whatever it is, we know it. We know it. We might not let the rest of the people around us know it, but we know we've got this problem, and we know we need to fix it. So, can we do any? About 10 minutes. Yes.
You know, I took Collier wrote about that. You remember, did you read his where he said, you know, you can't help the thoughts for coming into your mind, but you can turn them right off you know, like a faucet. You don't let it start dripping and then running and then overflowing. You just, he didn't give that bad analogy, I do, but that's it. Turn it off in the very first place. And I remember Alfred Norris saying one time, there are just some streets you can't walk down. There'll be signs or there'll be ads or there'll
right.
be something or other. And he said, if that's a temptation to you, go a longer way, take another street. And I think that's a good thought, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the things that I didn't finish this verse here, but every man is tempted when he's drawn away of his own lust. So we start with lust, and then we add some sort of excitement to that lust. You know, whether it's in our mind, we can just tempt ourselves just sitting there, and you start thinking about your particular lust. Or something can happen out here. Okay? There's sometimes been arguments in Christianity about whether Jesus had an external tempter. That's impossible. He could have had his lust excited by something out here, but temptation has to happen in here. Temptation is the moral choice, those crossroads in your mind. Nobody can tempt you out here. It's a misuse of the word and the way we're talking about it biblically. They can test us. They can excite our lust. But the temptation has to come in your head. It has to come in your mind. You have to come to that crossroads yourself. And you're the only one that can stop it. You're the only one, as was said, that can say, you know, I'm going to pray, or I'm going to clear my mind of this, or I'm going to flee. You know, Paul uses the phrase, you know, flee from sexual immorality. For those people that have that lust, that's what they have to do. They have to flee. And so, now what's interesting here, some more interesting stuff here, says they're drawn away of their own lust and type, and when lust hath conceived, it bringeth forth sin. And I'm going to suggest to you that what this is telling us is you don't have to do it to sin. You just have to, in your mind, choose the wrong path. I'd do it if I could, right? So, you know, the brother in my example, the 7-11 example, he's reaching over for the money, and the guy walks out from the back. Oh, I think he sinned. Because in his mind, he's committed to that act, but he didn't get a chance. The result is important, but not the main thing. Some brother, is just going to slander somebody, as we were talking in Duncan's class yesterday, just going to slander them, but the opportunity never presents itself. Still, in his heart, he committed that and committed to that course of action. So the conception of lust and temptation, I don't think, has to be acted upon in order to be counted as sin. And again, Jesus never did that. How amazing is that? That he never committed to doing something that was wrong, much less doing something that was wrong. He never committed mentally to doing anything that was wrong. Any questions or comments about that? Right.
We have others that are just equally as awful or deadly to us.
Right. Absolutely. Good point. Yeah.
Sort of along with Bob, I haven't thought this through, so maybe I should not even bother to speak. But so on one hand, you're saying that God puts trials in our way to help us learn to overcome them. But on the other side of the coin, if we could trust one another, and we're told to confess our sins to one another. And so if I could trust you and told you I have a problem with X, then if you love me, I would hope that you would never put X in front of my way. So how do you marry those two concepts?
Well, let me get to the next slide.
Okay.
See if this helps. Okay, here's the promise we were talking about, alluded to earlier, 1 Corinthians 10:13. There had no temptation, I think that should be test there, taking you, but as such is common to man. But God is faithful, who will not suffer you to be tempted or tested above what you are able, but will with the temptation or the test also make a way of escape that you may be able to bear it. So I think the promise is that we have from God is He's not going to stack the deck. He's not going to put us in a position that we couldn't overcome something. So there's part of the answer to your question. But also, you know, it's like it goes to the Romans 8. You know, sometimes we don't know what we need. In fact, probably more times than not, we don't know what we need. And so sometimes we may be saying, God, you know, don't put me in this situation anymore. And He puts us in that situation again. And it goes back to that trusting, you know, that God knows what He's doing, and accepting that, yeah, I do need to be presented with this again. And praying that He will give us that way of escape. And the funny thing about the way of that, not funny at all, but that way of escape, you know, what was Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego's way of escape from being thrown in the fiery furnace? You know, they didn't know that He was going to save them or not. Their way of escape was to die. And if they sin, you know, they had the choice of bow down and sin or die. And that's what all they knew for sure. And of course, God did give them a way of escape. But, you know, doesn't mean the way of escape is going to be easy, is my point. You know, you might have to take an extreme escape route to get through some of these trials that we're faced with. But to me, the key is knowing God's there working with us and not working against us. And it's better, I think, to be proactive than reactive to these things. You know, and Rachel brought up confessing. Were you talking about confessing faults to your brethren or just to God?
No, to each other. Because if I confess my sins to you, and then you understand what is my lust, and then if you love me and you are a friend to me, I'm hoping that you wouldn't deliberately put that in my way. You wouldn't.
Right. Would make it hard.
And I would do the same to you.
Right. Yeah, and a friend probably wouldn't, but a friend that only knows so much, and God knows everything. So God sometimes says, no, that's not what you need.
But maybe a good friend would try to help you overcome that, as opposed to trying to sort of remove that exposure from your life. Maybe they would try to work with you on that.
Did you get an answer?
Yeah.
Fun, good enough. We're not tested, we're not.
You're not tested, you're not working. You go out and find a rock in the field, and boy, you know, that's a heavy rock. Well, there it is, you got a rock. But you break that rock up, and you heat it under tremendous temperatures. And all the bad stuff kind of floats off to the edge, and you end up with pure gold, silver, or whatever. And He's not looking for a pure rock.
Right. Right.
Regarding the second man, if it's no temptation at all, the lesson is this. Seems like even with Jesus, the possibility has to be there. And then you're looking for it.
Yeah, the point on the second man is we're just trying to explain the difference between a temptation and a trial. You know, the same set of circumstances, although it wasn't really a trial for the second brother, the same set of circumstances were created by God, but it didn't touch anything in that person because they had a different set of lusts. That was the purpose of that. Yeah, it really wasn't a trial for him because it didn't excite anything. But the other brother, you know, the brother B, the one that wasn't tempted by the money, walk out and he would get another. A real trial.
Even
Yeah, I mean, there are people that would have no interest in that money whatsoever. You know, it's just, I mean, let me give you a crass analogy. A guy walks out here in, you know, a Speedo bathing suit. That might be a problem for some ladies in here, maybe even some men in here. But it's not going to be for me. I mean, just being honest, it's not going to be for me. It's not going to enter my mind once, Ray, to, you know, any sort of lust that's going to be excited by that. And I mean, I'm just, that's, again, it's a crass analogy, but there's no temptation there, you know. But it might be for somebody else. So it's not a trial for me. It's not a temptation for me. But it could be for somebody else. And the circumstances are reversed, you know. It might work. You know, if a lady in a bikini came out, it would be a trial and a temptation for me and not for other people in here. So, you see what I'm saying?
No.
You've
grown up Jesus in the wilderness.
Yes.
And you said it was in his mind.
Yes.
It's in his mind.
Yes.
The hunger or whatever has to be real.
Right. And my point, I guess, just on the Jesus thing was, whether somebody out here was telling him, you know, bringing these trials up, or whether this was all in his mind, and I happen to be a person who thinks this was in his mind, but if it was out here, it doesn't make a bit of difference. In order for it to have meant anything, it has to be in his mind when it comes to a temptation. He had to have something excited in him that touched him in a way where he had to make a moral choice, or it was a meaningless exercise. Right. And that's a good point, you know, about consequences, you know. The consequences are all, the ones that really mean something are all divine, right? We may commit adultery and nobody knows, but God knows. And the consequences are the same divinely, whether anybody finds out or not. So, you know, but there are consequences, and look, you know, we could tell story after horror story about people's sins that devastated ecclesias and devastated, you know, family lives and so forth. We're out of time. Okay, I'll leave you with this verse. Luke 12:35-39. And ye yourselves like unto men that wait for their Lord when he will return from the wedding, that when he cometh and knocketh, they may open unto him immediately. Blessed are those servants whom the Lord, when he cometh, shall find watching. Verily I say unto you, that day he will gird himself and will make them sit down to meat, and will come forth and serve them. And our fasting will turn into feasting. And we all long for that day, and I hope that we're all there together. Thank you.